From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, some Sherpas are calling for a strike just as the peak climbing season at Mount Everest gets underway.
But first, Vice President Joe Biden is in Ukraine today to show support for the government there and to demonstrate the United States' commitment to the region. But the visit comes amid reports of violence in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian militants continue to occupy Ukrainian buildings. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is in the town of Slavyansk in eastern Ukraine. And Eleanor, Secretary of State John Kerry said that Russia would see further costs, those were his words, if the Geneva Accord that was agreed to last week was not implemented by the weekend. That accord called for all illegally seized buildings to be returned to legitimate owners. So is the Geneva Accord being implemented?
It's absolutely not, and it doesn't look like it's going to be anytime soon. We were at the administrative building that's been taken over by the separatists, and it's basically a bunker, a heavily guarded fortress. They've got a perimeter around it. You go inside, there's sandbags everywhere. Up in the upper windows, there's sandbags. I was told, you know, shooters could hide up there behind them. It's a fortress city, and they say they're not leaving. They're not leaving until the people in Maidan step down and until a referendum on independence or joining Russia and leaving Ukraine is held. So they're absolutely not leaving, and the population supports them. They say these separatists are protecting their city from the fascist elements in Kiev.
They're saying that because they truly believe that, or are they under pressure to say something like that? What's your sense?
No, they're not under pressure at all. You could say they're deluded from maybe propaganda, but they're not under pressure at all. A mother was getting her picture taken with a masked camouflage separatist with an AK, you know, a Kalashnikov rifle, and her little girl, they were getting their picture smiling like a day out at the fair with, you know, a stuffed bear or something. And I said, you know, what are you doing? She said, we're very proud of them, and we're so glad they're here protecting us. So the people really do feel that way.
Vice President Biden is there in Ukraine today in Kiev. What kind of an impact is his visit likely to have?
But on this area here, absolutely none. I know that Biden is coming. The agenda was about the economy. You know, they're getting big loans from Europe, the IMF, and Ukraine has to do some austerity and you know, get its economic house in order. They were going to talk about corruption. But I think it's going to be upstaged now by security issues, because this weekend in this town at a checkpoint, one of the separatist checkpoints, three people were killed. And now those people are being called national heroes here. Pictures of them were up today. People were laying flowers. So no one's talking about the visit of the vice president. And I think that they're going to have to be talking about the violence here in Kiev. I don't know how the Ukrainian government is going to get control over places like this, because, for example, the police cars have been commandeered. They're now being driven by the separatists, who put a new, like, sticker on the front that says the People's Republic of Donbass. And Donbass is this coal region in the east. And they had Russian flags, or they have this flag for the Independent Republic of Donetsk. They were flying these flags, and they've basically taken them from the Ukrainian police and, I guess, the Ukrainian army. So I think the Ukrainian central government has lost control of towns like Slavyansk.
And what about the economy there? Of course, if you go back to the beginning of this entire crisis, before Ukraine's president in Kiev was ousted, it was about an economy that needed help badly, and whether the Russians were going to help or the West was going to help. But how's the economy there where you are?
Well, it's horrible. You can tell right away, because actually Donetsk is a nice city, but here it's really downtrodden. It's really depressing. You know, factories that are defunct, and just it's grim, really. And the people are talking about it. They're saying, we can't live on the, basically, man says, I make $140 a month. I can't live on that. And they say, you know, Russia has punished them with, you know, restricting trade if they go towards Europe. They really think Russia can help the economy. Being with Russia, they said, you know, we make parts for Russian military, for Russian machines. We make things that Russia buys. We need to be working with Russia. So a great deal of it was about the economy. And as soon as you come to a town like this, it's down and out. And so you feel that the economy is a major factor. But the people seem to think that Russia offers them a better future than Europe does.
Even if Russia gets some new sanctions from the United States and the West.
Absolutely. I mean, I think those sanctions here are seen as on individuals, and people aren't paying attention to the details. A lot of people said, we'd like Russia to come protect us. They really have this fear of fascists in Kiev. They really believe that the government is run by fascists, and everyone keeps talking about this group called Right Sector, which is a you know, a hard right group operating in the west of Ukraine, but they're not a majority of the people in Kiev, but everyone here seems to think that everyone in Kiev is from the right sector. One thing a guy said that really struck home, he said, nobody ever asks our opinion in the east. They do what they want in the west, and nobody ever asks us here. So they feel really neglected.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joining us from Slavyansk in Ukraine. Eleanor, thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And to Nepal now, where some of the mountain guides, called Sherpas, are calling for a boycott after Friday's avalanche that killed 13 of their own with three still missing. And just days before the beginning of the peak climbing season on Mount Everest, this was the deadliest disaster on the mountain. And Sherpas, foreign companies that make millions bringing climbers in, and Nepal's government, which takes in millions in royalties, are all in talks about how to go forward. The BBC's Surendra Fuyal is in Kathmandu. And Surendra, there was a meeting today at the Everest base camp with expedition members from different countries and Sherpas. What were the Sherpas asking for?
Basically, they're demanding better facilities, a better compensation, the insurance premium, and, you know, all that amount be raised for the Sherpas who risked their lives to help foreign climbers, international climbers, reach the top of the world.
What about the government there, which is very involved in the climb?
Yes, that's right. The government, takes royalties and all kinds of, you know, money and amount from the climbers. So there was a meeting between government officials and the mountaineering operators in Kathmandu. The meeting has remained inconclusive as of now, but tomorrow they are meeting again. One of the officials present in the meeting told me just a little while ago. So the meetings will continue. He says he's very hopeful that some kind of agreement will be made and the Sherpas will be back in their business, as there are more than 300 climbers who have gathered, international climbers who have gathered at Mount Everest Base Camp at an elevation of 5,300 meters. They are currently acclimatizing there, preparing for the expeditions. And, you know, just on Friday, this avalanche happened and everybody is naturally very, very disturbed.
Well, who has the most leverage in this negotiation? We know that these climbs can't happen without the Sherpas, who so well know the mountain and are brave enough to go out and rebuild these paths that have been destroyed by an avalanche. Nobody would do that work for the $6,000 over 3 months that they do it for. But on the other hand, that's more money than they can make doing anything else. The average salary in Nepal is about $700 a year. So that $6,000 over 3 months is many times that. So who has the most leverage in this?
The government, of course, stands to benefit a lot financially, you know, in terms of royalties and other financial benefits. The problem here is the amount of risk involved, you know. It's high paying, it's very well paying, but at the same time, there's a lot of risk involved. And they are, after the disaster on Friday, the Sherpas at the Everest base camp are getting calls from their family members, calls from their wives, calls from their mothers and sisters and brothers and other relatives, asking them to just return home and abandon the whole thing called mountaineering or climbing Everest, because everybody's pretty scared and disturbed after the avalanche. So at this point in time, both parties, the Sherpas on the one hand, and on the other side, the government officials are trying to negotiate and find a solution so that it will be beneficial for the both parties. So we'll have to wait until tomorrow to know what exactly happens.
Surendra, what is the feeling in the country as a whole? This is something, there's been a tension around Mount Everest for decades. The risk that the Sherpas take at the low pay, what the climbing does to pollute the mountain. On the other hand, it's a source of income. So what's the sense in the country after this terrible disaster?
Now, you know, I mean, after this disaster, naturally, there are concerns for the safety of the climbers. There are concerns for the safety of the Sherpas. And also there are concerns about rising pollution. And also there are, you know, concerns about climate change having adverse negative impacts on the Himalaya with, you know, glacial lakes growing in size and glaciers shrinking literally because of the high rate of melting of ice and snow up there. So there are all kinds of concerns there. And when, you know, incidents like these happen, they make international headlines. And this is precisely when the Sherpas try to shout out loud for their rights and their benefits and their welfare, which they naturally deserve.
As one family says, the Sherpas are the muscle on the mountain. You say there's a call to raise the minimum insurance payment for those killed on Everest. What are they the families paid now, and what do they want it to go to?
Immediately after the disaster happened, there was a meeting at the Home Ministry, the Interior Ministry, and the meeting decided to give away a sum of rupees 40,000, which is about around $400 to each of the affected family. Sherpas at the base camp were just not happy with that. They were naturally enraged by the government decision. They also seized the opportunity to ask for higher insurance premium payment rates and other facilities like timely rescue, proper medical treatment, higher medical insurance rates, and things like that.
Well, as you said, that $415 was emergency aid, but the insurance payment to the family of a deceased Sherpa is about $10,000. They want that double to 20. But given that the government takes in millions from these expeditions, that just still seems awfully low.
They're also asking that, demanding that the government pay, allocate 30% of what it earns from royalties for the welfare of the Sherpas who are involved in mountaineering and who work as guides and porters and things like that.
Just to be clear, you're saying that they're asking that 30% of the millions that Nepal takes in royalties from these climbs, they want 30% of that to go to sort of a relief fund for all of the people involved in climbing.
That's right. That's one of the demands. And they are basically asking that we risk our lives to make mountaineering expeditions successful, to make mountaineering climbing happen. So the government must care about us and our families. If we lose our lives, then our children will be orphaned. They will need some social security and other benefits too. That's basically what the climbers are asking, and that's their main demand.
The BBC's Surinder Fayal in Kathmandu. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, he who regularly mocks the powerful, the famous, the foolish, has another side to him, which is on display in today's Boston Marathon. For the second year in a row, at the invitation of a group called Team with a Vision, he's running the race as a guide to a legally blind athlete. This year, Peter's running with Eric Manzer, who at the age of 3 was diagnosed with a condition called retinitis pigmentosa and who's gradually lost much of his sight. Both Peter and Eric ran the race with others last year, crossing the finish line just before the bombs went off. Like many, they are determined to finish today, only together. We spoke with them as they waited at the Hopkinton Vision Center this morning. That's a store that's hosted the visually impaired for years. As they waited for the race to start, we started with a question to Peter. Why do this?
I became a classic midlife runner and ran a bunch of marathons, 10 in fact, at this point last year, and was really sort of wondering why I was bothering. I mean, I've run thousands of miles, and yet here I still am. And I got a call from a remarkably energetic young gentleman named Josh Warren, runs Team with a Vision. That's the charity athletic arm for Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And he said, hey, do you want to guide a blind runner in Boston? And I was like, yeah, sure. By the way, this is also how I got into public radio. People call me up and they say, you want to do this? I go, yeah. So last year I lined up at this very same place with a guy named William Greer, a visually impaired runner from Austin, Texas. And we had a great race. As he said, it was a great race except for the bombs. And I did find that running a race for someone else had real pleasures to it. I wasn't thinking so much about, like, why am I doing this? And this hurts a lot. I was thinking, like, how's he doing? What does he need?
Well, hold up for a second. That line was incredible from your running mate last year, William Greer. It was a great race except for the bombs. As you all know, this year the thinking of a lot of runners is to try to have that attitude, you know, just to make the what happened last year secondary. How hard is that?
I don't think it's that hard because for runners, Boston Marathon is, as everybody knows, the premier event, the amateurs Olympics, right?
Someone drove that point home this morning by writing, imagine if your pickup softball game was allowed to go on the field with the Red Sox.
it's a little bit like that, you know? And so most years when most of the world isn't paying that much attention to the Boston Marathon, the running community, it's our big, you know, it's our national holiday. We, all of us, can name the towns. Framingham, Natick, Needham, Boston College, Heartbreak Hill, like Stations of the Cross to downtown. So for us, last year was this sick anomaly. And I think that people wanted to come and run it, not so much to somehow respond to the bombing, if you will, but to erase it. to remind everybody by running it this year and next year and next year till the end of the world that this, you know, the Boston Marathon bombings have nothing to do with the Boston Marathon. Let's call them something else, please.
Yeah. With that in mind, let's talk about this year's race with Eric. Can you, do you mind handing your phone over to Eric
he
Manson?
He happens to be right here. Eric, okay. I would like to speak to you.
Hey, good morning.
Hi, how are you? Eric, our first question is, why are you trusting Peter Sagal to take you along the course?
A very fair question. Actually, I have become familiar with Peter, and as you can tell, he's very charismatic and engaging and very deserving of trust, as I've come to know. Or so he tells me. He's a handsome fellow as well. So I've come to know him pretty well over the last couple of days. And, you know, one thing that I've always kind of observed about, you know, the blind athlete guide relationship is it has a way of kind of fast tracking that comfort level. And you basically surrender yourself to them for the duration of this race. And so you develop that comfort level and that trust and that communication level. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, I know that your site has been limited for a while, so the world is what you know of it. And yet for those of us who have trepidation running and we have sight, it's pretty astonishing. So what are some of the things you need him to help you with? I'm thinking potholes here at post our terrible winter in New England.
Oh, absolutely. No, frost heaves leave a lot of damage out there. I describe what I see now as basically like looking through a cloudy keyhole.
Mm.
You know, if I'm looking straight ahead, I can't see my feet. I can't, you know, I've got nothing below and or off to the sides. And so the most daunting part of a race for me is very much like the beginning where everyone's packed in like sardines. People are jockeying for position. And literally, from my point of view, it's as though people are appearing out of nowhere if they're cutting mm-hmm. across that field of vision.
Some of the pairs tether to each other with, you know, literally a leather rope so you don't lose each other in that pack in the beginning.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that's critical, especially at the beginning of the race because, you know, without even knowing, people get between you. And before you know it, you're five people separated. And
mm-hmm.
So having that connection of the tether is key. Plus, you know, self-identifying, wearing a bib that says blind, where, you know, having Peter have the bib that says guide on it, it just raises awareness and people kind of have a great respect. So that helps a great deal. My default in previous races has been to avoid the clusters of people, but this is such a special year and such an emotional experience that I'm just going to soak it all in, and it's not something to be missed, and it's such a special thing to be a part of this year.
Yeah. Well, Eric, we wish you all the best. Can you hand us back to Peter just to sign off?
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And by the way, what's your number?
23258.
Okay, we'll follow you, 23258. And just hand over to Peter for a second.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hello.
So, Peter, you got quite a responsibility today.
Yes, I do. Isn't it interesting?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking you're the guy who, as we said at the outset, we think of sarcasm, we think of
bitterness,
mocking.
Sadness lurking behind a mask of humor, I know, yeah.
This is something else.
Yes, it is. It is, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just have to get out there and just help somebody face to face. You know, the Massachusetts Association for the Blind, we had a brunch the other day, and it was there for the marathon team and the runners and the guides. But there are also people there who help blind people shop or mm-hmm. read to them, or care for their pets, or do their laundry, or whatever is needed. And, you know, those people are doing the same thing I'm doing. They're just getting a little less attention for it. But it's tremendously important. And I think not just for the people who need the help, but for the people who offer the help. I get to feel good about myself. And let me tell you this, just between you and me, Robin,
mm-hmm.
volunteering, chicks dig it. Just saying.
Okay.
I don't know if that matters to you, but, you know, I'm just saying.
Well, it obviously does to you.
Yes, clearly. I exposed my shallowness again, but that's nothing new.
Peter, what's your number?
I am looking, and I have to read it upside down. It is 18624.
18624.
Yeah.
Running and guiding 23258.
Yes, and if you check those numbers and you find that they are very far apart, something has gone horribly wrong. I may have made one too many tasteless blind joke, and Eric is like, that's it. I was saying I will make my plan is to either enrage Eric so that he is trying to chase me, or just annoy him so much he tries to get away from me. And either is motivation for him to go faster. So I can't see why this will not work.
Peter, thank you so much. Best of luck.
My pleasure, and give my best to Hobson.
We will do that. NPR's Peter Sagal and Eric Menzer on a cell phone as they wait to run this morning. Peter guiding Eric today over the 26.2-mile course. What could go wrong? We'll link you to the site where you can track their numbers. Again, 18624 and 23258 at hereandnow.org.
Reports today say a group of investors has agreed to pour $450 million into Airbnb, the home rental website that would value it at $10 billion, making it one of the most valuable startups in the world. Meanwhile, representatives of the site are due in a New York court tomorrow facing allegations that people who use Airbnb are illegally renting out their apartments. Joining us now is Derek Thompson, business editor for The Atlantic, senior editor for The Atlantic, I should say. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, how big of a deal is this reported investment of $450 million into Airbnb?
It's huge. Like you said, the new deal makes Airbnb one of the most valuable startups in the world. $10 billion. You compare that to the market caps of some public companies in the hotel business, it makes it more valuable than Hyatt, more valuable than Safeway. So you think about how people a few years ago were saying Airbnb is going to, quote, eat, end quote, the hotel business. It's sort of doing that already. It's more valuable than Hyatt.
And it's got more rooms than a lot of major hotel chains that we've heard of, even though, of course, Airbnb doesn't own all of these rooms that are being rented out all around the world. Now, what about this court situation, though, tomorrow, that people, especially in New York City, are worried that Airbnb users are renting out apartments, which violates all kinds of subletting agreements?
There's a 2010 state law in New York that prohibits renters from subletting their homes for more than 30 days if they're not present. I asked Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky about this last year, and he acknowledged that this is a good law. It was written because slumlords were kicking tenants out of buildings and turning them into hotels. And Airbnb essentially says, this has nothing to do with us. This isn't what we're all about. They say that 87% of their listings, 87%, are from hosts renting out their own apartments, often to help them make rent. It's awfully expensive to live in New York City and San Francisco, a lot of the cities where Airbnb has really taken off. The state, however, claims that about two-thirds of the city's apartments on Airbnb are illegal. So it's subpoenaed for all of Airbnb's New York records. And that's basically what they're going to go into court about, whether or not Airbnb has to turn over all these records to show once and for all that these apartment listings are legal and that they don't violate this slumlord law written in 2010.
How is Airbnb doing in that little thing that so many tech companies forget, which is how to actually make money?
Profit? What is that? Well, startups are risky. Airbnb does have hundreds of thousands of listings all over the world in tens of thousands of cities, from apartments in the U.S. They have castles in Europe. There are millions, over 10 million bookings total. You know, they're an exciting part of this movement that's sometimes called the sharing economy, where people are sharing what they're not using. The internet allows them to turn their down capital into real actual money. Whether that becomes a sustainable profit for Airbnb, it remains to be seen. And it should be said that just today we had the mobile payments company Square, which is also one of these hot Silicon Valley companies that's now in discussions with people to sell because they're not growing at the same speed that they thought they would. Startups are risky. And the bet that investors are making in Airbnb is that it's simply too big now to fail.
It's interesting that you brought up Square because, of course, they had raised hundreds of millions of dollars. Today we're talking about Airbnb getting $450 million in investment and now Square recording losses in the $100 million a year is now looking to sell, perhaps. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Let's get the latest now on that ferry disaster in South Korea. So far, more than 85 people confirmed dead, 220 remain missing. The captain and two other crew members have been arrested on suspicion of negligence, and South Korea's president says their actions are akin to murder. Reporter Jason Strother is a freelance journalist based in Seoul. Jason, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, the president has come out and said that what happened on this ship was akin to murder. Tell us more about what she had to say.
Sure. Well, President Park Geun-hye, she made these remarks after transcripts were released of radio communication between the crew of the ferry that sank last week and ground control that pretty much painted a very frantic picture. The crew didn't really seem to know the best way to evacuate the passengers on board. Ground control seemed very concerned that the passengers weren't going to get off in time. She said it was unimaginable how the crew could be this negligent. However, I think her remarks, you know, have a different meaning. Ever since this ship sank last week with the hundreds of passengers on board, it's really been her administration that's taken the heat from both the families of the victims, and also, I think, overall, the South Korean population feels that the government botched this rescue attempt one way or another. I think she's now deflecting that criticism and rechanneling it to the captain and the crew, which he, Captain Lee, is under arrest right now, as well as several of his crew members, and they're facing a slew of charges, essentially for abandoning the ship.
But have they responded to these charges that they did something that was akin to murder?
When Captain Lee Jun-suk appeared on camera as he was being arrested, he said that he'd done the best that he could. He was afraid that if he had passengers put on life jackets and jump into the sea, that they'd be swept away by the current or even freeze to death in those cold waters. The rescue boats hadn't arrived yet. But it is clear from the transcripts that there was a lot of confusion and that the distress calls came out at least a half hour after the ship started to capsize.
Do we have more of a sense of how this happened in the first place?
You know, the investigation is underway right now. The prevailing theory is that while the ship was passing through this one part of the Yellow Sea, the crew might have tried to take a shortcut. And it wasn't even Captain Lee who was at the helm. It was his third mate, a young woman only identified as Ms. Park here in local media, who evidently had no experience navigating these waters. It's thought that she made a very abrupt turn, which caused all the cargo on board, cars, freights, container boxes, to shift to one side of the ferry and thus caused it to capsize.
And what about the rescue efforts at this point? Are they still rescue efforts or at this point is it recovery?
I think they're still calling it a rescue and not a recovery out of consideration for the families that are still camped out on the island of Jindo, which is the closest land point to where the wreck occurred. They have been very critical of this whole operation. The families say the Navy, the Coast Guard, the government dragged its feet, that rescuers didn't make the kind of progress they expected of them. Even though divers are just pulling out corpses at this point, they're definitely not ready to call it just a recovery.
And I'm just trying to think, if something like this were to happen in this country, to have potentially hundreds of people, young people, dead from a ferry accident, it would shock the nation. How are people feeling in Seoul?
Jeremy, I think the overall impression here in South Korea is, you know, while I think there is still a lot of anger at the government for what people perceive as a botched rescue attempt, they're also upset that this reflects just a lack of safety standards that exists here in South Korea. You know, this nation moved very fast. It developed very fast. It became a first world economy overnight, essentially. But a lot of things got skipped over in that march forward. And some of that includes even the basic things like safety concerns, having enough lifeboats on ships, these kind of things. And I think South Koreans are fed up with these companies like this ferry operator who cut costs. And I think this could cause, you know, somewhat of a consumer uprising here, where people start demanding these types of improvements in order to make things like public transportation more safe.
Reporter Jason Strother joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, it's Monday. That means NPR music writer and editor Stephen Thompson has a new song for us to take in. Stephen, what have you brought?
I've got a duo with a nice, long, cumbersome name, The Ghost of a Saber-Toothed Tiger. It's a band featuring Sean Lennon. He's the son of John Lennon, mm-hmm. and he's been making music with a very smart singer and multi-instrumentalist named Charlotte Kemp Mule. And when they first got together a few years ago, the music they were making sounded kind of trippy and light. But on their new album, which is called Midnight Sun, there's more of a churn and a grind to these songs. There's darkness and lightness that are more intermingled in ways that are really interesting and powerful. This song from the new album is terrific. It's called Animals.
Everywhere you go, you're in a microscope. You're living in a fishbowl and your mind's under control.
Stephen Thompson, some people of a certain age will find it sweet that you felt the need to point out that Sean Lennon is the son of John Lennon, because to them, it's something they've never forgotten, and you can hear John Lennon's voice.
Well, first of all, I love to be clear about these things. Never
right.
assume that anybody knows
right,
anything.
Right, you can't. Right.
But there is a definite similarity there, and I don't think that he could avoid that if he tried at this point. It's kind of a blessing and a curse when you think about it. Sean Lennon is part of a continuum, but he's also standing in a long shadow, and he's clearly got a lot of his own artistic impulses to contend with. Remember, he's also the son of Yoko Ono.
Who could forget?
Exactly. And to me, part of what is so cool about The Ghost of a Saber-Toothed Tiger is that it feels like it's of a piece with where John Lennon might have gone musically had he lived. It's got a bit of that classic-sounding pop to it, but it's got teeth to it as well. And there's kind of a weird, paranoid vibe to the sound, which I'd describe as almost like retro-futuristic. It's familiar in a sense, but it's also always forward-thinking, and I love that.
Okay, well, Animals from a new album, Midnight Sun, by the band The Ghost of a Saber-Toothed Tiger, which is composed of Sean Lennon and Charlotte Kemp Mule. NPR music writer and editor Stephen Thompson, thank you so much as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Yesterday, actor Denzel Washington released this statement: God bless Reuben Carter and his tireless fight to ensure justice for all. In the 1999 film Hurricane, Washington portrayed the middleweight boxer who lost his bout with cancer Sunday at the age of 76, and decades ago was wrongly convicted in a New Jersey court, not just once, but twice, of murdering three people.
I was a prize fight. My job was to take all the hatred and skill that I could muster and send a man to his destruction. And I did that. But Reuben Hurricane Carter is no murderer.
We're also being reminded today of Bob Dylan's 1975 song Hurricane, which told the story of Carter's first conviction and a jail sentence, even though witnesses to the triple murder said it wasn't him. And he and John Artis, a friend who was with him that night, passed lie detector tests.
Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but what?
The song became a hit, Reuben Carter a celebrity. The case against him overturned when witnesses recanted. Carter and Artis were briefly freed and then tried and convicted again by the same prosecutors, who now said they'd committed racial revenge, killing three whites in retribution for the death of another black man. Back to jail they went, and away went most of their new friends, except for reporter Selwyn Robb of the New York Times, fellow fighter Muhammad Ali, and musician Tom Kidron, who wrote a song for Hurricane Carter 2 years before Bob Dylan did.
He fought his way to fame, known as a hurricane, declared an act of war against injustice that he saw.
Tom Kidron lobbied relentlessly for Reuben Carter, who admitted that as a kid he'd been filled with rage, that he served time once for assaulting a man. But in 1985, a federal judge ruled he'd been wrongly convicted in the 1966 murders, citing prosecutorial misconduct. Tom Kidron is now CEO of the internet 3D company World Online. He joins us in the studio, and condolences, because this was a personal loss for you.
Thank you very much.
What drew you to him when so many had turned away?
Well, I think Ruben had many strong characteristics. Certainly his power of presence. He did have a very strong aura about him, physically strong, but more importantly, I think the energy that he put out, a tremendous smile, a tremendous intellect, a great quick wit. But Ruben also had a human compassion, a component that could tie into your heart. And I think the combination of the injustice that was done to him, his ability to suffer through that, and certainly when all people turned their back on him, which was striking because everybody believed the system was corrupt and unjust, and how could the same system retry him and not but find the same verdict? But that was sufficient enough for people to say, well, he must be guilty because he had his second trial.
Well, and as it turned out, and as a New York Times investigation continued to show, the system was that bad, that it was that bad twice.
Correct. Much of the system was based upon promotion for achieving this tremendous conviction against, at that point, the biggest murder in New Jersey history. So that system was throughout corrupt.
Well, and you, I know you're going to balk at this because you're here to talk about Reuben Carter, and I can see in your face that that's what you want to do. But it has been pointed out, Howard Manley wrote a column in the Boston Sunday Globe in the year 2000 when the film came out, pointing out that when just about everyone went away, you did not. You know, in the film, you'll see him in his cell reading all sorts of books on philosophy. Where did he get those books?
Well, I brought them to him. Reuben, would you joke to me and say, I'm your big experiment, aren't I? And I said, look, the fact of the matter is that no matter how many books on law you read, you are not going to free yourself. The system has to work its way through. But you have to be free within your mind and expand your mind through more esoteric type of reading. And we had long debates about that. And ultimately, he started to read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, Surviving Concentration Camps, Viktor Ouspensky. And we had these long, many, many hours of conversations about that. And I could see in his demeanor, he became less strident in his speaking style. Very philosophical. He started to melt. The angry person that felt that he was truly unjustly charged and had a sole purpose of vindicating himself through the legal system realized that he had to get above that.
Well, and what's he been doing in the decades since? He's fallen off the radar for a lot of people. We know he co-founded a group in Canada that was sort of the Canadian version of the Innocence Project. Had he been successful?
Well, he had worked very long and hard and felt that the gift that he had been given through his celebrity and his own cause had provided him with a platform to speak out against others that were unjustly charged and wrongly convicted. He worked with another group to free inmates that were unjustly charged and wrongly convicted and eventually left them and formed Innocence International. And Innocence International now will be a program at Tufts University with the Reuben Hurricane Carter John Artis Innocence International program at Tufts University, which is where his papers will be archived, and it'll be a proactive program for students to work with those that are wrongly convicted.
John Artis, again, the man who was in the car with him that night, who was arrested with him, but also eventually cleared, wrongly convicted.
And was with him the night he died.
Well, tell us about that. USA Today was reporting that the woman who co-founded the Innocence International Project with him, or at least was involved in recent years, Wim Rahr, visited Reuben Carter in his last days. He was incommunicative. He couldn't speak with her, but she says she told him that she'd just returned from an Innocence Project meeting in Oregon. The Innocence Project is the U.S. version of the same idea. About 113 exonerees were there at this meeting in Oregon, and they all signed posters thanking him for his work. So within that community, and it's a very large community now of people who've been exonerated, he was certainly well known.
He was recognized worldwide. He was asked to speak at many lectures around the world on this behalf. He was pointed in not wanting to use his history other than as an example, but more to focus on those cases that he felt merited his ability to bring the spotlight to them.
You've been in touch with him. In fact, you had a voice message on your phone, and we asked you to play it back. Let's just listen to a little.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, Ruben? I'm here waiting for you. How you doing, brother? What's up? You on a trip somewhere? Were you out of the country, out of the world? Tell me, where are you? Just calling, brother, to touch down and see how you doing. I'm all right for the moment. But give me a call, you get an opportunity. Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Awfully upbeat for someone who's staring at a fatal illness and had this history of losing such a portion of his life already. What was your sense of Reuben Carter in the last days, last months?
He was lucid. He was not giving up the fight. He said, look, I know death is coming for me, but I'm ready to go. I've done what I could do. I've met who I wanted to meet. I've said what I had to say. And I've had a great life, and it's been heaven for the last 28 years.
Did he feel he made a difference?
I think he strongly felt that he made some mark, and that if anything, he would hope that his legacy would be that people would remember him for speaking out for those that were wrongly convicted.
Tom Kidron on the death of his friend Reuben Carter, Hurricane Reuben Carter. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.